Commerce Committee. It is 1:30 on February 9th, 2016. I'm Senator Mia Costello, and with me I'd like to welcome Vice Chair Senator Giesel and Senator Ellis. Welcome. I would like to thank the Recording Secretary Nancy and Matt, who's our LIO operator. Appreciate your assistance. Just briefly, I'll go through the agenda for today. We have, again, a packed schedule. First, we'll bring up Senate Bill 69. We had moved this from committee, Senator Ellis. However, we did not have the new fiscal note, so we will be rescinding our action. We'll have the department explain the new fiscal note, and then Senator Giesel will make a motion to move the bill version H with the appropriate fiscal note. Following that bill, we will then move on to Senate Bill 161. Short title is Exemption and Licensing of Contractors. We'll have the bill presented from my staff, and then from the administration we will have two individuals testifying. We do have members of the public here and online, so I want to just mention now, if testimony could be around 2 minutes, that helps with the flow of the committee. We also have a guest speaker today, Dr. Christian Kettles. He's here in Juneau as a guest of the Juneau Economic Development Corporation, or Council, excuse me. He is one of two nationally known experts on economic development who will be with us this week. And Dr. Kettles is a professor of business strategy at Harvard Business School and has a PhD in economics from the London School of Economics. He will be talking to the committee about his ideas for economic development, and then I wanted to also welcome Senator Stevens. So with that, let's go ahead and rescind the motion. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that Labor and Commerce Committee rescind its previous motion on the CS for Senate Bill 69, version 29LS0675/ECHO. That was taken a couple meetings ago. Okay.
Is there any objection to rescinding our motion on passing Senate Bill 69? Okay, seeing none, it is so rescinded. And now with us we have Janie Hovenden and Sarah Chambers to explain the new fiscal note.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Division Operations Manager for the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. The fiscal note that we have attached to this bill is it's substantially the same as the prior fiscal note. It's been updated with FY16 personnel numbers. The CS, although it achieved some changes in the bill, it did not make an impact to the fiscal note, so we are continuing to attach that note to the bill as it's been revised.
Okay. Do you mind going through the changes in the employees, please?
Sure. The personnel that's being requested is about as minimal as we can request a body to come and perform the work that is in the bill. The changes are updates to not only updated salaries for cost of living increases, but we did reclassify our occupational licensing examiners from a range 13 to a range 14, commensurate with the duties that they are performing. So it's slightly higher than the previous fiscal note because of the salary increases. We are only requesting a part-time staff member to take on the additional work.
Okay. Are there any questions from committee members? Okay. Seeing none. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the CS for Senate Bill 69, Labor and Commerce, version 29LS0675/ECHO from the committee with previous individual recommendations and attached updated fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Okay. Seeing none, the bill moves from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the documents. like to welcome Senate President Kevin Meyer. And next on our agenda is Senate Bill 161. This is the bill's first hearing. We'll hear from the sponsor's staff, Weston Eiler, from the administration, and then we will take public testimony on the bill. And just another reminder for those who are interested in testifying on this bill, Senate Bill 161, there are a few individuals signed up to testify. However, at 2:15, we will be taking not a break, but we will be having Dr. Christian Kettles here. So we'll try to do as much of the public testimony as possible. But if not, then we will keep that open and continue that at another meeting. So with that, I'd like to welcome Weston Eiler, who's with my staff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Weston Eiler, staff to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Senate Bill 161 provides protections for consumers purchasing a home from an unlicensed builder. Currently under state law, there's an exemption that allows individuals to build structures without a contractor license. AS 818-161 allows anyone to build one structure every 2 years without a license. This was intended, the exemption, to allow Alaskans to build their own home. What we are starting to see in terms of trends from the industry, though, is that a growing number of individuals are using this exemption to operate more or less what would be considered construction business. The wording currently in statute that this bill aims to address makes it tricky for enforcement. It allows potential abuse by those who would seek to build homes for sale without the required licensure, insurance, and bonding that professional contractors and home builders have to obtain. Senate Bill 161 helps prevent abuse of this exemption. It requires anyone who builds and sells a home without a contractor license to disclose the fact that they do not have a license to the state within 2 years after completing construction. So this does not prohibit the owner-builder construction. Doesn't require any form of state approval for owner-builder construction. This simply calls for a disclosure to the Department of Commerce for builders that are building their own home without a contractor's license and then turning around and selling that home or structure within 2 years. The idea being that this will allow the department to monitor this phenomenon, make sure that this loophole or the exemption that's again intended to have the freedom for Alaskans to build their own home doesn't become or isn't subverted towards commercial use. The only other thing I'd mention, Madam Chair, is the legislative intent that is mentioned in Section 1 of the bill. I'll just add that for the record. It is the intent of the legislature that the exemptions listed in AS 08-18-161, amended by Section 3 of this Act, be construed broadly in order to allow individuals the freedom and ability to construct and sell their own homes based on their own discretion. So again, Madam Chair, no new mandate, no new prohibition. This simply allows or calls for disclosure to the State Department to protect consumers who are purchasing a home from an unlicensed builder. SB 161 is supported by the Alaska State Home Builders Association, and that concludes my testimony. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. At this time, I'd actually like to invite Janie Hovenden to provide comments from the administration, and if the administration supports the bill, that would be helpful. And then after that, we'll have members' questions.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Janie Hovenden. I'm the Division Director for Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. This bill does require that the owner-builder within 2 years file with our department a form that we design that would, if they are stating that they are not engaged in business that requires a contractor's license. And we see no fiscal impact to our division for that.
Thank you. And just for the record, Weston, if you could just explain what is the problem that this bill is solving?
Madam Chair, again, Weston Eiler, staff to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. This is primarily a protective measure just to ensure that consumers that are purchasing homes from unlicensed builders are able to track that, that they're able to know that who they're buying their home for is or is not a licensed contractor. We're seeing, again, as you know, Alaska grows, especially in various regions of the state, there's a need for a little bit of consumer protection and how that is done. We certainly, the bill isn't intended to hamper or limit any individuals from building their own homes. Simply, we want to be able to track and have disclosures for folks that are not contractors but are building structures and then turning around and having commercial dealings or sales of those. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I want to mention, too, we have Al Nagel with the Department of Labor, who's online from Anchorage for questions for the committee. And also Sarah Chambers is here with the division, also with the Division of Corporation Businesses and Professional Licensing. So are there any questions from committee members? Senator Stevens?
Just to help me understand what difference it makes to the consumer, whether you buy a house from someone with a license or someone without a license, what are the protections you have as a consumer buying from someone with a license? I don't quite understand that.
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, again, Weston Eiler, staff to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Partly it's protections to make sure that, you know, there can be, you know, due course and accountability if there are problems. Just as a little bit of background history, when there was a housing crash in the 80s, the state legislature really tightened the requirements for home builders and contractors. There was bonding, a variety of insurance, and kind of new standards that were put in place. There are also a variety of programs through Alaska Housing Finance and others that really tried to ensure that efficient quality homes, you know, through the state licensing were occurring. From a consumer standpoint, it's something that is good to know, but it's also primarily a preventive measure to make sure that this exemption of the owner-builder exemption of folks building their own homes doesn't become subverted and used to where, you know, whole families are doing an owner-builder exemption and then turning around and selling those. So what we're seeing a little bit with industry, and I know we have members from that sector with us today, is that there are, you know, groups, and I won't characterize again, Senator, but there are groups where we're seeing a good variety of homes that are built by non-contractors entering the commercial market. And so this will at least allow state government to track that and see, you know, if there needs to be investigative measures, if there are loopholes within the exemptions or with statute that are being subverted.
So Senator Stevens?
I'm not sure I understand yet, but so, for example, if you bought a house and it was from somebody without a license or versus buying it someone with a contractor's license, I guess what I'd like to know is, are you better protected with a licensed contractor if, for example, the roof should fall in or, I don't know, or the foundation fail? Do you as a consumer have more protection with a licensed contractor than you do from somebody without a license?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I'd be happy to provide kind of more of a breakdown in terms of civil remedies after sale. Partly, I guess, what this bill is trying to address is that home builders and contractors in the state are held to quite a high standard in terms of what's required of them to construct buildings and homes. Part of this is kind of a back-end measure to make sure that folks that aren't held to that same standard is still on the up and up. But I can provide more information to you and your staff about the civil remedies.
Senator Stevens, if I might actually take a stab at that, it is a consumer protection bill because what you're trying to do here is to protect those individuals who've purchased a home. They think it's all up to code. It's been, you know, built by a licensed contractor. And then when they go to sell it, they find out that, you know, they have work that has to be done that costs quite a bit. And so I think that it's really, in my mind, a good government transparency bill. But I think we'll hear more today from the people who are here to testify. So
thank you.
Let Weston off the hook. No. Okay. Senator Giesel.
Thank you. Mr. Eiler, on page 3, lines 4 and 5, near the end, it says, within 2 years after the period of construction. So the person who has built this home, who's not a licensed contractor, is constrained for 2 years after the period of construction from selling the house. How do you measure when the end of, or after the period of construction, how is that defined?
Through the chair, Senator Geisel, if I might, specifically to the rationale for the two-year period or just the...
I don't care about the rationale. I want to know how it's measured. Is it when the last nail is hammered in? Is it after the person who originally built it moves in? Is it... when does the clock begin for the two-year time period?
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Geisel, if I might, I'd like to consult with legal and make sure I get you the right answer on that.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Are there any other questions from committee members? Okay. Seeing none, I'd like to go ahead and open public testimony. Thank you for coming forward. First, I would like to invite Paul Michelson. Paul, welcome. And if you can, just mention your name for the record and then go ahead.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Paul Michelson. Last name is spelled M-I-C-H-E-L-S-O-H-N. I'm a general contractor out of Anchorage, Alaska. I've been in the business of home building for approximately 42 years. This bill, I'm here today representing the Alaska State Home Build Association and the industry as a whole. We feel this a bill of this sort is long overdue. It's a problem that has been going on for years. I can't testify to the bill. I think your staff did an excellent job, so I won't take the time to do that today. But I will give you an example, Senator Stevens, through the chair, that happened just very recently. I was hired by a warranty company to investigate a house that was approximately 16 months old, actually built in the valley under a unlicensed contractor provision. And I was called up there because there was no way to contact the unlicensed individual. And I went up there and they had a septic. They were complaining of a septic smell. We did some tests and studies on the septic field. It was completely failed system. The system was not registered with DH, Department of Health and Human Services. It was the well logs were not registered with Department of Health and Services. Either was the building in general. There was major interior drywall flaws, trim flaws, and now there was no recourse for the person that bought the house. And the person bought the house under the assumption that it was built by a quality contractor because it was advertised as so, and it was advertised by a real estate agent. And that's just one incident. I had another incident down in Sterling, a similar thing. Owner-builder built the house, marketed it immediately. I was hired by a warranty company again to go down and investigate because they could not finance the house under the provisions that it was built under. So I was asked to go down there and assess the quality of the home, and I found approximately 22 code infractions on that house, and my recommendation to the warranty company was not to warrant it. I believe you asked a question of the gentleman previously. Are houses built by contractors better to the consumer, to the end user? I feel they are because the contractor is held through bonding and stuff. We're held at a period of 7 years for structural, usually 1 year on the warranty of general maintenance, but by state law we are held at responsibility for 7 years against structural damage. We are held to an integrity issue. We are required to have 2 years or 20 every 2 years we have to have continuing education credits that we must pass and prove that we are keeping up with today's technology. That's changing rapidly every year. The houses are getting tighter and more efficient, and they're actually getting stronger. And this is more affects more of the rural communities, more of the outlying areas, areas such as Anchorage and stuff where we have a building department, we have a code department, we have a inspection department. It's not as crucial, but when you buy from Eagle River North, and Eagle River, I'm not saying does a bad job, I'm just saying that's where the enforcement area stops, then it's a big problem. When you get out to your outlying areas such as Valdez, Glen Allen, Sutton, that's where you have a large portion of the problems going on. And I could sit here and bore you with case after case after case that I've been involved in, but I think by your reaction you get the point.
Okay. Senator Stevens?
Well, thank you, Paul. I really appreciate that explanation. So if that were the house that you had built, the one that had the sewage treatment problem, what would have been your responsibility? What would you have done to mitigate it? Or as you said, what would have been the recourse the owners would have had if you were the builder?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I can only speak for myself on that issue, but I've gone back on warranty problems at up to 5 years, depending on the client-contractor relationship. I am obligated for 1 year, but if I have a really good client that I like, I've gone back as much as 8 years. But in a case like this one, it would have been registered. If I had done the job, I would have registered the septic system with the Department of Health and Human Services. I would have logged the well and registered it with the department. I would have got a call from somebody, and quite frankly, I would have been fixing the system. But to answer more honestly, it wouldn't have failed in the first place because I would have done it correctly.
Well, thank you, Paul. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate you coming to Juneau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it.
Next is Andre Spinelli here in Juneau. I have you down to testify. There you are. I see you. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my name is Andre Spinelli. I'm the president of the State Association, and I won't repeat everything that Paul said, but kind of have the similar story. I apologize for my voice. But this is an issue that the state home builders have been working on for quite some time. And we've wanted to see reform in this area for a long time, and this is probably less than what we had hoped for, but it's a start. And and we would hope to see the your support.
Okay.
That's all I have.
All right. Any questions for Andre? Right. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate you testifying and appreciate you working so diligently on this issue. It seems to be pretty important. Thank you.
And I have a letter here. Should I give
it? Oh, you can give that to Weston, and we'll put it in the bill file. Thank you. Okay, next I have from Kenai, Jeff Twait. Jeff, can you hear us? Oh, you're here.
You too. Yes.
Well, I should have known because I think there's a whole contingent here in town. All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm a builder in Kenai, Jeff Twait. And to kind of to follow up a little bit on what Senator Stevens had a question, I'd like to say that we as licensed contractors, we're mandated to have licensed plumbers and electricians do our work. We're not allowed to do it ourselves. Where these contractors that are unlicensed are probably primarily doing their own electrical and plumbing work. So plumbing maybe not a life-threatening issue, but electrical certainly can be. So that's one of the things I think where it really becomes a consumer protection bill as well. Again, Kenai and Soldotna in city limits, not an issue because we have building officials and we have permitting issues. Outside of the outer lying areas is where we have the problem, and it's not a huge problem, but we are seeing more of it happening now. So that's all I have to say.
Okay. Thank you very much. Oh, Senator Giesel.
So, Jeff, do you know how one measures the 2 years? No.
Through the chair, I don't. I believe it's whenever occupancy would be taken, I think. But I wouldn't swear to that.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Next, I will invite Jess Hall. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jess Hall from Palmer and Wasilla, a builder up there. And I just wanted to urge your support for this bill. I pretty much agree with what the other builders have said. There is one other little issue that the bill we hope will address as unlicensed contractors are concerned. And that is, we see a lot of cases in the valley where a so-called owner-builder is building a house, except they're doing one or two or three a year as unlicensed contractors, but calling themselves owner-builders. But as soon as they start the house, it's listed in MLS. They have a sign for sale out front. It's a spec house. It's not an owner-builder house. I think everyone in the state feels that owner-builder is you building your own house for yourself to live in, not you building a house that you're immediately selling and never going to live in it. That's an unlicensed contractor, and that's what we hope this bill will address, because we've had issues with the Department of Labor being able to enforce that because the present language is hazy as to how it addresses that, and we believe this language will clear that up. That's one of the biggest issues that we see. We, as professional builders, the statute's always been there. You can build your own house for yourself once every 2 years, and we're fine with that. But when you're building two houses a year, three, five, that's a different story. Now, you just don't want to pay for the bonding and licensing and education that we have to go through. The two-year part for professional builders like myself is pretty simple. We have all our houses inspected by inspectors that Alaska Housing has approved. And so we do what we call a PR 102, which is the inspection report. Once that's signed off by the inspector as being completed, that starts our two-year date, but then we're licensed builders. Now, some owner builders will have the inspections done, and they have that same form. So for them, that's a pretty concise spot where the 2 years starts. Not all owner builders don't do that. If they want to finance their home through Alaska Housing, they have to have those inspections done, and that's a good thing. But not all of them do that.
Any questions? Mr. Hall, can you talk briefly about the scope of the problem?
In the valley, it's pretty big. There are a lot of builders, primarily new builders, that have tried to skirt this. I can't tell you what the number is, but it's probably in the 10 to 50 range of builders that aren't licensed out there. And they seem to come and go. And you see the names pop up on the deeds or maybe an MLS listing that you've never heard before. And pretty soon they're not there anymore, and there's new names, and the list kind of seems to be growing over the last 5 years. It's been pretty interesting. I'm not somebody who drives around trying to find out who they are. I'm busy trying to run my own business. But you know, I've heard a lot from my trade contractors that work for me, heating guys, plumbers, sheetrockers, so on, that do a lot of work for other builders besides me, and they're out there seeing that a lot more. They're approached by a lot of unlicensed builders to do work for them. So over the years, I've kind of pieced all this together to figure out how it's all happening. And there's a lot of other things besides what this bill addresses that goes on with unlicensed builders that if I was a home buyer, I'd want to be a lot more aware than I am. And that's the flip side of it, because I get people that will call up and want to talk to me about building a house, and this may be their second house. Well, their first house they bought when they moved out from Anchorage or up to the state for the first time, and you know, house is listed, a realtor signs out front for sale. They assumed it was built by a builder, because in Lower 48 they don't have owner builders. It just doesn't happen. The banks won't finance owner builders pretty much. We're unique in that respect. So and they think they have that assumption. Well, they move into the house, and then they find out all these problems, and Paul Michelson kind of addressed that pretty succinctly. There are issues with people that do that, particularly when they're doing their own heating and wiring. So I get people that have come in occasionally that are looking to move up to a different house or location or whatever, and they'll tell me about some of the issues they've had with their house. And that's one thing to have sheetrock cracks or some other minor warranty things that every house built in Alaska will have. It's another thing to have structural issues or mechanical issues that clearly don't meet code, and you just kind of feel sorry for the people, because now they have a problem. When they go to sell that house, for the most part, buyers will require a home inspector to come in and inspect that house. Like half the house I build, they hire their own home inspector to come in, even though I've already had the inspections done, and they'll do another inspection. And we're fine with that, because our inspector missed something, we'd like to know about it, take care of it. Doesn't happen very often, but occasionally. So, you know, all of a sudden they have these expensive repairs to fix that should have never been there. I mean, the cosmetic stuff, yeah, it's understandable. You got wear and tear or whatever on the house. But those kind of issues, I just feel bad for them. And sure, when we build them this house, they're not going to have those issues. they do, they call us up. We'll take care of it under our warranty. We'll just fix it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, I would like to invite Aaron Welterlin.
Hi, Madam Chair, members of the community. I'm Aaron Welterlin from Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm also a member of the Alaska State Homebuilders Association. I think you guys are getting the point of what we're trying to get across here, but the real key is that owner-builders are key to being able to build their own houses. We want them to do that. We just don't want them to be able to do it multiple times and sell homes. You know, we are held to a much higher standard. You know, we have high insurance requirements, we have bonding requirements, and we are here to fix homes when you have an issue at the end, you know, and that's the whole point. And if we didn't fix those houses when there's an issue, we would not be in business still because we would have no reputation. I don't have a lot else I can say aside from that.
And it's my understanding the bill requires that the owner-builder file with the department, so it's just
yes.
on record.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, it's a simple one-page form is our understanding, and just say, you know, I'm having to sell this house, you know, and that's it.
Well, thank you very much.
I really
appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
So I have one additional person who's signed up to testify, and that is Patrick Dalton. Patrick, if you could provide your testimony.
Yes, this is Patrick Dalton. I happen to be a contractor and also a citizen, and I'm going to present to you a different, totally different point of view than you've heard. And one thing I think we should keep in mind is that the state of the economy in this state right now and in the country is extremely critical. And for us to be throwing money at stuff like this when we've made it so far without these kinds of laws is really irresponsible. Our state is going to go bankrupt. They're talking about negative interest rates in Japan, which means people are going to be pulling out of the economy left and right, pulling that money out of bank. And a lot of experts say there's going to be a big crisis coming. And for our state to take on additional responsibilities like new licensing systems, new enforcement, and all this kind of stuff is not very wise. Now, another thing I'd like to bring up is that there's a private property issue here. And this really gets down to a philosophical disagreement that I have to express with you guys that are on the side of this contracting bill, and that is the following. Are there any free market economists, I hope, in general at all? I mean, this is a thing of letting the economy drive the price of houses and the building of houses. And when the government interferes, we've seen time and time again that it usually gets in the way. The private free market is the way we need to look at this. Now, there are, as Mr. Hall mentioned in Palmer, there are other ways of complying with you know, safe housing and things like through the permitting systems. And then the other thing I'd like to bring up is local is better. You know, if you want building and licensing in a certain area to be the way that area wants, it should be done at the borough level. But to drop laws that are going to apply clear across the state, and by the way, I live in the unorganized borough, and I happen to see a lot of places where structures are built because they have to be built by people who are there, and the enforcement would be a nightmare out here. And I think that local is better. I think that this should be taken on at a borough level. Anchorage can handle their licensing and their permitting system and their enforcement the way they want, as can the North Star Borough. And I think the way it is currently all right. But when we add another level of control on a person and restrictions on a person selling their own home that they built, for whatever reason they decide to sell, that is their private property. It gets down to constitutional issues. Private property is what made this country great. It's in our Declaration of Independence. Private property was recognized as a cornerstone of a free society. And I think a lot of people come to Alaska, and in the unorganized borough especially, they come here because they feel like it's their castle and they're free to use their private property as they see fit. And that includes selling it. It is not right to attach requirements on an individual to sell their property. And so if you philosophically stand back and look at how we're going to handle issues of market and property, I think maybe there are other ways of taking care of protecting, as you call it, protecting the consumer from shoddily built homes. And so I don't think we should look at the lower 48 furthermore for a model, as one of your testifiers mentioned. I don't think we should model our state after anything in the lower 48. Sure, there aren't home owner builders in the lower 48 in very many places. But that doesn't mean that this is bad the way we have it here. I think we enjoy a little more freedom here in Alaska, and that with that, there's a responsibility of the consumer when he buys a house to be very careful and maybe buy a house that has been inspected and maybe develop a certification system where houses can be certified and inspected before someone buys. And so I'd like to see the discussion here in the legislature move more toward how can we certify homes in a way that does not infringe on personal property. And the discussion should be more of free market economy. And if anyone builds a house, we should be thankful that they are participating in the system and stirring up employment and growth in a time when the economy in this state is very much in danger. And I thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dalton, for providing that other side of the coin. I am going to go ahead and leave the public testimony open, and we will be taking a brief at ease while our guest speaker comes forward. So with that, I'm taking it at ease. Good afternoon. Senate Labor and Commerce is called back to order. Next on the agenda, we have a guest with us this afternoon, and Dr. Christian Kettles is here in Juneau at the request of the Juneau Economic Development Council's Innovation Summit. Dr. Kettles is a professor of business strategy at Harvard Business School, and he has a PhD from the London School of Economics. He is president of TCI, which is a global network of professionals involved in innovation and economic competitiveness. And he's going to introduce the committee to the concept of clusters for economic development and competitiveness. And I had the pleasure of hearing you at the Innovation Summit, and I want to say it was very thought-provoking and riveting. So I want to welcome you personally to the state capitol, and we're looking forward to your remarks. And as I mentioned, we'll let you proceed with your presentation, and then we'll take questions after you're completed.
Thank you, Senator Costello, and ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak here. I said yesterday, and I want to repeat it today, that I think we often underinvest time in speaking to the legislators. We often speak to business leaders and to government administrators, but I think it's very important to share these ideas about economic development also with you. Let me also add that I have a lot of experience in academic research and competitiveness and regional economic development. What I definitely lack is a deeper understanding of the Alaska economy. I'll share some thoughts on Alaska, but I think the main value that hopefully this can bring to you is kind of a way of thinking of framing up the problem and the experience from other locations. So maybe we can draw also on that in the discussion afterwards as we move on. So it is a little bit of a mouthful, a cluster-based economic development, a strategic approach towards enhancing Alaska's competitiveness. Let me try to break it down a little bit more and you know see what this means in practice. First of all, of course, the starting point for this economy is the challenge that you're at the moment exposed to in terms of the fiscal struggle that the state is facing because of the drop in oil prices. Now, this is not the first time this has happened, but nevertheless, I think this is a very difficult moment to rethink, you know, what does the state have to do, what should it do in terms of moving forward. The type of concepts that we've seen move applied in different locations is trying to be a bit more systematic in this process, and how do you draw on data about your location to make the right choices. Now, if you look at the situation in which the state is at the moment, it's obviously, and I'm sure this is consuming a lot of your time and efforts, how do you deal with the fiscal retrenchment? How do you make sure that, you know, we make ends meet at the state level and deal with the shortfall of incomes? And that requires a lot of courage to make the right kind of decisions. What I would venture is that it's also important to think about making these cuts and making these choices in a way that is not undermining the competitiveness of the state as you go forward. And that's much easier said than done. But I think that's exactly the type of difficult choices on priorities and what is really an investment that helps you to stay afloat or ideally be a foundation for future growth as you move forward. So this is what this term strategic plan is all about, trying to make thoughtful decisions about the priorities that you want to set. An important term that you see there is the notion of competitive advantage. And those of you who've come out of a business career know competitive advantage for companies. What does it mean for a location? Well, in our work, I think what we see is that locations do much better if there is a clear sense of what they offer as a place to do business to companies, also what they offer to individuals in terms of a unique value that they have. And here's the question to Alaska, you know, what is our competitive advantage that we have? How is the competitive advantage or set of competitive advantages that we want to build in order to move forward? Now, I think one turn in the way that economists are thinking about this problem, you know, how can you make these choices about what types of competitive advantages to build and what types of policies to use, is that we've moved away from the view that there's one silver bullet, some one plan or one recipe that works for all locations all the time. What we, I think, instead are in terms of our thinking is that there are some general principles, concepts, you know, what is competitiveness, how can you think about clusters in this context, but these then have to be applied in the specific reality of your state. And that's one other reason why I certainly don't come with a solution. I think I come with a way to look at the reality and try to interpret the patterns that you see about the Alaskan economy to then make informed choices. I also want to point out that economic development is not like math. It's not like you put in the data and there's only one solution. It still requires choices. Choice by government, by business leaders, by academic leaders about where do we want to go? What is it that we can jointly create in our economy? Now, I use the term competitiveness, and you know, I think it's important to clarify the language a little bit, because competitiveness is used by many people in different contexts, and often we understand different things about it. When I talk about competitiveness, what we have in mind is really what's the level of prosperity that a location can generate for its citizens, keeping in mind that the wealth is created by companies. It doesn't come from anywhere else. It has to be kind of generated in a market process. But that has two implications. I mean, first of all, a competitive location is one where companies that are located there can actually compete successfully, not only locally, but also nationally and ideally even globally in the global economy. So that's a lot about how attractive are we for businesses. But that's not enough. We also have to think about how is that economic activity in companies actually generating prosperity. And quite often, I think, in the political realm, we too often have debates about, you know, who is going to gain. Is it the employer, the employers, or the employees? Is it about wages? How can we kind of divide the cake? Competitiveness is about the size of the cake. And then we'll fight and, you know, we'll see who kind of gets the crumbs and who's contributing most. If you think about the size of the cake, I think there's pretty much consensus in the economics field that it's all about productivity. So you have to think about how can we raise the productivity of our companies in our location. And that, I think, is an important, useful test for pretty much every policy or program that you might have in front of your committee. What's the impact of productivity? Is this going to make companies more productive, able to create more value as we move forward? Now, what are some of the theories or the ways that we think about, you know, what might be driving the performance of our locations? So one view is that it's all about what we have inherited, you know, our natural resources, but also our location, where we are, how large we are as an economy, and, you know, that's something to think about. Others argue, no, it's all about what we do, you know, having the right industries, being in the sectors that seem to be growing, dynamic, the future. That's what it's all about to be competitive. And then the third view, I would say, is, you know, what we have created. What is the kind of conditions we have jointly as a community created in terms of the infrastructure, the skills, the rules and regulations, the openness of markets, and so on. So let me look a little bit at the evidence on all of these to kind of share the thinking that I think, how I see it in our field. This is the performance of U.S. states. So, you know, on the horizontal level, you have GDP growth rates for the last 15 years, and then on the vertical rate, you have the GDP per capita level. So you see Alaska there, the size of the bubble is the overall GDP of the state. Very high up, not very high growth rate over the last period. Probably the GDP per capita as measured here is overcounting the quality of life, because the natural resources, as in Delaware, which is even higher, kind of includes a lot of money that actually doesn't go to the citizens of the state. It's kind of profit share of the large companies and so on. But nevertheless, that's kind of the starting point. That's what we're trying to explain. The gray bubbles are the states that have more than 10% of their GDP generated by oil and gas. And what you see is that some are doing quite well, some are high growth, some are low growth, some are higher prosperity, some are lower prosperity. So what seems to happen is that natural resources provide you some opportunities, but then it depends a lot on how you deal with that, how you integrate that in a wider economy. What are some of the forces that are at play here? Well, natural resources are kind of a direct wealth effect. It's like money that's kind of falling down on you, and that's kind of a good thing, depending on what you do with it, but it makes you more prosperous. We also see that natural resources can be a trigger for industries to grow, related industries to grow. And I just wanted to show one example here. You know, I mean, Texas is one in the U.S. that has created a lot of knowledge industries, markets, services around oil and gas. Norway is a more recent entrant into that field, but they have been one of the few cases where they've really been able to create a globally competitive supplier industry focused very much on kind of the deep sea exploration activities. So they're very active in Africa, very active in Brazil, and global markets. But the thing that you see here is that you can sell natural resources, but this also can be a starting point to be good in other things that really kind of create value out of your knowledge, out of your capabilities that you have. Unfortunately, natural resources also have a lot of these red things, and that's what Alaska is facing at the moment. It's a price that you don't control. There's a lot of volatility. It creates economic distortions because it tends to bid up prices for wages and other costs, which makes it harder for other industries to succeed. Political incentives, too much focus on government, and it's bounded. You know, at some points, there is an end to the resources that are in the ground. So there are a lot of reasons why natural resources alone are not going to sustain a prosperous and competitive economy. So what is then industry composition, the type of sectors that you have? And I think this is where I think the what we call the cluster perspective provides a little bit more insight in trying to understand where we are at an economy. So what we did in our research is kind of look at industries and divide them in two groups. One is what we call the traded industries, and those are the sectors that you find in some locations where they concentrate and are strong, and many other locations don't have them at all. So, you know, think about Boeing and aerospace production in Washington State. You know, Washington State has very strong employment. Many other states have nothing. But then there's also local industries, and those are the industries that you basically find everywhere at the same proportions as overall population, GDP, local retail, local education, local healthcare. In the U.S., these local sectors are actually two-thirds of employment, so this is where most of the jobs are. These jobs, however, have not the same productivity and wage levels that you see in the so-called traded sectors. And they also don't have the same type of innovative capacity. Patenting rate is here just one measure, but we see also the productivity rate in these traded sectors much higher than the local sectors. Both are important, but they play different roles in your regional economy. If you look as analysts or as policymakers at your regional and state economy, you have to understand how we're doing in these two sectors. Is it that the local industries are kind of not creating the right kind of dynamism? Often that has to do with rules and regulations that might hinder them, or other markets that are not functioning. Or are we lacking on the traded clusters because we are not really having distinctive competitive advantages? We are not being able to create things that are also competitive outside of our state. So we need to understand these dynamics, and this is kind of a first step of where cluster thinking has helped us to really get a better sense of what is the competitive dynamic in these different industries. Within the traded industries, we then have grouped those that are closely connected because they co-locate, they use the same types of skills, they have strong input-output relationships, and that creates about 50 different groups of what we call cluster categories. And one of those is biopharmaceuticals, and here's an example of Boston. So clusters really are kind of this combination of related industries. Is not just one narrow activity, but it really brings together related types of activities, and that's what creates dynamism. It is proximity. The interaction in a certain location is what makes them more productive, the ability to learn from each other, to be very quick in the interactions, and the linkages, you know, these arrows that you see here. So how they are collaborating. There are differences location from location. You know, some are just co-locations, others very actively work together on R&D issues, on products, and so on. Looking back to our kind of this bubble chart of the U.S., you know, now it's very colorful. What I've done is I've kind of colored the states, some of the states, by this the cluster category in which this state is dominating. So, you know, in finance, Illinois and New York are the states that both have a high absolute number of employment, but also very high specialization. So they have more jobs in these industries than you would expect just given the overall size of the state economies. You have IT, Massachusetts, California, Washington State. You have automotive. You have tourism. So what we see is that different regional economies, you know, and Alaska is just one of the examples of it, have very different specialization profiles. You also see that there seems to be a relationship to performance. Now, here it gets somewhat complicated because I think what we see is that it is true that more prosperous states tend to have certain types of industries like finance, like IT, like analytical instruments, like biopharmaceuticals. We also see that these more prosperous states tend to have a broader portfolio of activity. So they are not just narrowly specialized, but they have a couple of areas. But it's really that the clusters then help them to have a high level of productivity in the sectors in which they are active. And that tends to matter a lot. So what we see in the results is that about two-thirds of the prosperity gap to the average for every state is driven off by how good you are at things that you do. And one-third is driven by the fact that you're in tourism versus financial services. So both are important, but as a development strategy, I think it's very important to make sure that you are very good at the things that you already have, and then gradually, I think, over time, migrate to more value-added activities. So this is kind of a simple map to try to understand how these things connect. How prosperous are we? Well, it is depending on what we do and how well we do it. But this industrial composition that we have is affected by our natural resources, our location, but also by the business environment that we've created. And I think what is important for policymakers is that if you intervene directly at the level of what we do, it has a short-term impact, but you don't really address the fundamental drivers of what makes companies in a certain sector productive and competitive in their field. So I think what state government should think about is, what are the business environment conditions that we create, and there's a range of them. You know, I think what we've seen more and more in economic research is there is not one lever that you have, but the business of good economic development is kind of to getting all the small ducks into row and make sure that you have an overall puzzle that makes sense, that you really have a set of conditions from workforce skills to infrastructure to rules and regulation to your internationalization efforts that fit, that work together in order to help the type of businesses that you have in your location. So I've tried to kind of summarize this in a number of principles. There is no silver bullet. I know a lot of people come with, you know, this is the one solution. I don't believe in that, and I think you should be very critical as to whether that really works. Many things matter. Many small things matter. What is important that you do them in a coherent fashion, that you have an overall view on how they interact. And the way they interact, and that makes it so complicated, is depending on what you already have. Now, what does that mean in practice? We all know that skills is absolutely critical for the future of any location. But if you increase more skilled people, but you still have bad infrastructure, and you don't have effective companies, then what you create is unemployed skilled people. So you have to have a package of the right type of policies to be successful. To have that package ready, you need to understand where you stand as a state. That's why, you know, I think the conclusion here, every location is different, but you can learn from these principles as you diagnose and understand the economy that you have. Getting to process, and I think this is where we as economists often have made the mistake that we treated this as a pure analytical problem. The reality is also needs to be done. And if you identify 50 things that need to be done, the likelihood is you don't do anything. So the challenge is, how do we sequence? How do we understand what do we do first and where do we move then? To make things even more complicated, if you would control everything here and it's just, you know, a decision by this committee or by the Senate or by politicians, it would be easy, but that's not the case. You're reliant for the effectiveness of your programs on what private companies do, what the university is doing, what many other networks are doing. So you are more an orchestrator. You provide inputs and you set rules and regulations and you can provide money in some instances. But it's often about creating a consensus about the overall direction, and then people kind of make their own choices. Now a little bit on what we see out there in the economic development field at the moment, and you know, I largely put that out there because I want to make sure that you see, you know, people come up with all kinds of concepts, and all of them might have their place in a given situation, but you have to look at the bigger picture on what's right for your location. So some are very focused on specific firms and sectors. You know, economic gardening, a concept to help your existing local firms, picking winners, next big thing, you know, trying to bet on certain industries, or maybe FDI attraction, which, you know, a lot of locations in the U.S. have tried to do. Others have said, you know, no, let's not do anything about specific firms or sectors. Let's try to improve the business environment, you know, framework conditions, do something about schools, general education infrastructure, open for business, so the notion that the best thing government can do is get out of the way, placemaking being more attractive for people, or maybe, you know, big infrastructure projects, you know, stadiums, stuff like that. And then in the middle, I would say, you know, a little bit more mixed approaches, clusters and entrepreneurial ecosystems. I'll come back to that. What's the track record? I think it's pretty negative in most of these cases. So if you start with economic gardening, it's a good idea, but, you know, one company at a time, you're not going to change your regional economy. It just doesn't have the leverage to really kind of affect the needle of many outcomes. So you move to kind of open for business, placemaking, framework conditions, all good things. The problem is they do not create unique competitive advantages for your location. So if you think about a company, you know, are you buying a product from a company because they have dealt with all the things that the product did not deliver? No, you buy the product because it does deliver something that others are not doing. And locations have not traditionally thought about that way. But this is how companies react. They come to a place because here they find something that is uniquely attractive. Infrastructure programs, I mean, you probably know more about that than I do, that many of them fail, these big stadiums or other things. Big game hunting, FDI attraction, picking winners. largely a disaster, largely a lot of wasted money, not creating any sustained competitive advantages, you know, all the lobbying that goes into it, so really not a way to go. So we look a lot at these creating entrepreneurial ecosystems and clusters, and what is that really about? The idea is that you do focus on business environment condition upgrading, so the right infrastructure, the right kind of skill programs, the right kind of FDI attraction, but with a focus on a certain set of related industries. Because you're trying to understand how is our location competing in these industries. And the second part is kind of encouraging collaboration within these type of clusters. It's not about creating clusters or sheltering companies or giving them freebies or incentives. It's really trying to channel what you anyway do to a group where you feel that here it can have an impact. And you know, let me skip over that. There are many examples of other locations that's doing it. I picked Iceland because that was one of the locations that I know was also discussed, I think, last year here at the JDC context. Just to put this a little bit of context, as economists, we always think about, you know, market distortions and impact of economic policies. So that's why, you know, some people argue for these economy-wide policies, and, you know, I heard this term spray and pray. You know, you offer something to everyone, you know, a little bit thin, you hope that something will work. And yes, it is good in terms of avoiding market distortions, but the impact is often negligible. And so you're wasting a lot of money. Creating champions in terms of firms is exactly the opposite. You know, yes, you have an impact on that company, but not on your overall economy. Industry efforts, not that much better. The thinking behind cluster programs is you're not focusing on an individual industry, but really as a system of companies and industries that work together. So you get an impact, but the distortions are more limited. So that's at least the theory. The practice is that government has lots of instruments at its proposal, and some are more interventionist than others. And so, you know, here I try to outline some. I think the ones that are less interventionist but really can create competitive advantages over time are also the ones that do take time. So improving the business environment, enhancing collaboration, getting things going. But I think that's the reality of what tends to work and kind of creates lasting impacts. Sometimes things like FDI investment attraction can work if it fits into a context. And I would argue, you know, you might have read about GE relocating to Boston. I think that, for me, fits into this picture because there is a cluster that's kind of ready for this company and will benefit both GE and the community of having them come there. And I think in that context it might make more sense. Now, one of the things that we see emerge in many locations is that when you do clusters, often these kind of intermediary structures emerge. They're not quite government, they're not a private firm, they're not a university, they're a platform to bring these different players together. And, you know, we just heard a couple of examples from this region and the efforts in these different industries, and it's really trying to make sure that we coordinate what we do individually. And it turns out that these people have a lot to talk about because they are in the same sector. They are facing the same challenges and issues and have a lot of the same opportunities. Now, what I would argue is we have to understand what the potential is of the type of efforts as we do them now and what maybe government, state government could do to leverage them more. So what we've learned by looking at many of these initiatives that the impact depends on, of course, the things that they do and how well they do them. Depends on whether they really work with a cluster that has some critical mass and good business environment conditions, how the governance structures is, but it's really also about the integration into the policy process. If cluster initiatives are just a couple of people meeting as volunteers and coordinating their actions a little bit, that has an impact, but you can't expect it to change the reality of the economy. If these groups become a major mechanism for you and for other parts of state government to think about how do we allocate our activities? What do we do on skills? What do we do on infrastructure? How do we change rules and regulations so that companies can be more productive? How do we connect companies with the university system? That's where you can make a difference. But that requires kind of thinking about how you integrate these networks into broader fields. One example from a small place in Spain, the Basque Country, they have over the last 25 years really organized all of their economic development through cluster organizations. That has been the communication channel between the private sector and the public sector. And they've been very effective. What these organizations do has changed tremendously. You know, in the beginning, it was efficiency. It was entering the European market. Now it's a lot of innovation. But cluster organizations are an instrument. They are in a channel to help to do what you already do better. Now, with that background, you know, what is an approach that a state can take, you know, to figure out what are the right choices here? I think what we see is there is a diagnostic phase to really bring people on the same page. Where do we stand? What are our unique advantages? What are the opportunities that we have? What are the sectors in which we're already strong? Then you can choose and really try to say, you know, what are the advantages that we want to create? Where do we want to go? What's the direction? Where do we see returns coming up? And then it's about action implementation and creating the right kind of structure. Let me talk a little bit about this. I'll jump over that just to make the point that diagnostics is a very important part of the dialogue. This is not something you can outsource to consultants. It is really part of the community understanding where are we. And we've done lots of surveys at different locations. It's amazing if you look at the survey responses from government employees versus companies versus people in academia. You feel like these people live in different locations. And if that's the case, no wonder you can't agree on what should be done. So I think this is something, this is an investment that I think one might want to do. I told you, you know, I have been literally in Alaska now for 40 hours. So I'm not at all an expert on this economy. But here are some observations to start off. You know, what are the realities of this economy? What are some of its assets? What are some of its weaknesses? But I think so far the picture emerges to an outside observer that this is an economy that obviously is driven by its natural resources. And there is not many competitive advantages outside of that. So the question is, you know, if you want to diversify, where could these areas be in order to move forward? Now, we see in our data as a reflection of that, that actually you have a relatively low share of your employment in what we call strong clusters. And here is, you know, the ones that I've colored a little bit darker are the ones in where you are very specialized, and, you know, it's not a surprise, fishing products, obviously oil and gas, mining, hospital and tourism. The problem is that these are not very much connected to each other. And so there's the hard job is kind of figuring out what are the additional opportunities for diversification that exist given the base of capacity that you have. Now, I'm more optimistic after the discussions that we had yesterday also with a gentleman from the university system that there are a lot of pockets here of knowledge that could be interestingly commercialized. But this will not happen, at least not happen quickly, if there's not a kind of a broader thinking and a broader plan on how to do that. Ultimately, I think you want to end up with, you know, sort of strategic choice on what is the positioning of our economy, what do we want to be known for as a place to do business, how is that reflected in certain strength in the business environment and in certain clusters that kind of draw on these type of activities. And, you know, probably to get the discussion started, I think it will be around the resources, the natural resources that you offer, the unique demand conditions given the climate that exists here, the distances and so on, but also the attractiveness to people. There is, you know, not everybody wants to live in Alaska, but there are a lot of people that want to be here. And I think you need to think about what's the right segment. What does that allow us to attract? And based on that, you know, I think you can start thinking about what are the clusters, what are the existing clusters, how we can upgrade them, what are emerging new clusters. What are other things that we can do? You know, and we talked about energy. We talked about obviously ocean-related things, climate change-related things. So there are a lot of areas where you can do things. The good news is, I think, for an economy of the size of Alaska, you don't need to be a world leader in a large industry. One of the advantages of globalization is you can do very well if you're well positioned in a niche. That's quite enough. But thinking hard about, you know, what that area might be, and, you know, I think we talked about yesterday about remote sensing and, you know, geodata and so on. I think there are a lot of areas that you can build on. Now then, and I'm coming to a close, the final part is kind of the making it happen. And I think the big idea here is that a government-led model is not working anymore in this modern knowledge economy because you're just not controlling all the levers that are critical. But that doesn't mean getting out of the way as a solution. I think what government critically needs to do is kind of become an orchestrator and help using its credibility to bring the different players together to make sure that there is a neutral platform for things to happen. But economic development really is a collaborative process. So, you know, some thoughts on what we see for government, you know, getting the basics right, open markets, you know, keeping costs of doing business down, fiscal efficiency, and so on, but then use these instruments. So we need to stop thinking about government as mainly a source of finance and funding and providing money to certain activities, and much more about coordinating, making sure that you tap into the right sources, whether it's from the federal level, state level, or companies that want to invest in certain things. It's about bringing these things together. What we've seen in many locations is that a lot hinges on how you organize yourself. And I provided some examples here. So one task is kind of this agenda setting. How do we make sure that we actually do get people on the same page and understanding where we stand as a state economy? How do we have that dialogue? And that involves bringing in others. So some places, and this, you know, Denmark is one of them, but many other countries and regions have done that, have created competitiveness council that kind of have half political members and heads of departments, and then private sector representation, university, and so on. So that might be something to think about. Second aspect is the coordination. We usually organize state and federal government in silos, you know, functional specialties, you know, labor, education, infrastructure, da da da. Competitiveness is cross-cutting, and you need to make sure that you kind of integrate across these different sectors. And again, there are many different models. So in Finland, they have the Science and Technology Council, because they basically, also in a deep crisis, decided that we have to cut pretty much everything, but we want to shelter the science system, because we have to build on that for our future. To make that happen, they had a committee within government to coordinate the necessary choices. And then the third thing is delivery. If you want to partner with especially the private sector, you also have to speak the language of the private sector and make sure that there's efficiency in how you do that. So there are models of economic development boards, delivery units, all this kind of stuff. And again, you know, I don't know enough about the structure in Alaska, but that might be something to look into. And in some cases, that might actually be much cheaper than an existing system of, you know, where you have a lot of division and people do different things but are not integrated in what they do. Final slide, it's really about collaboration. These things do not happen just because a governor or a legislative session makes a certain decisions, but because you're able to kind of create a common sense of where you stand as a community and where you wanna go, and people kind of intuitively align their decisions. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kettles. Again, it was, you know, this is very interesting, and I want to open it up to questions from committee members first. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, and thank you for that presentation. Very enlightening. I guess I'd like to ask you a little bit more how government can serve in a, more of a coordinating role. I don't think we do that very well here. I think we feel like, you know, we need to be the funding of all the
right
activities through the state, and I guess I personally would like to see more of the firms or the private sector doing that, and as well as academia, as your last slide shows, playing a role as well. How can we, again, maybe you don't know our government, how we work very well, but how do you have any just tips on how government can work as a coordinating role better? Does that entail maybe more outsourcing, more privatizing?
Well, so I think it's more about how you organize the collaboration rather than outsourcing and letting others do things. Now, one of the models is, you know, and that's a first step, rather than thinking about, you know, the money that you hand out, handing it out to individual institutions to say, okay, you know, we are going to support certain things, but you have to come as a coalition. You know, we want to see groups of companies working with the university and maybe with some city governments to have a common plan. And if you convince us that you're knowing what you're doing and you have a structure to deliver, then we as state government are ready to fund these things. So that can be a starting point to get things moving. I also agree with you, you know, depending on the situation, it doesn't have to be the state government. It could be academia. It could be kind of large companies that are willing to play this role. You have to see kind of, but you need to have somebody that can step forward, that has a little bit the power and the credibility to do it, and also to do it in a neutral way, that it's not perceived as, well, they are going after their individual interest. It's not a concrete answer, but
yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
Senator Stevens?
I don't haven't really formulated this question, but Doctor, here we are in a state where we often have conflicting resources, and let me give you just an example. Fisheries versus gold. We've got a gigantic mine out in western Alaska in an area that is the biggest producer of salmon.
Right.
So it's really been contentious, and the gold would produce big, well-paying jobs for $100,000 a year,
right,
but only for maybe 25, 50 years.
Yeah.
So what I guess I'm trying to get at is that how do you make a decision between the renewable and the non-renewable, and just how do you get your arms around such a big, big problem?
Right. So unfortunately, I can't offer an easy solution. I think that's exactly the type of choices that, you know, I think the political process is about. You know, obviously, as an economist, you can say, you know, we can do discounted cash value assessments, and we can see what's the value of this gold mine and what's the cost that it imposes on this other industry. But politically, it's, you know, these are two interest groups that have their respective interests, and they are both fair, and you can understand that have to be balanced. I would say from a broader perspective, I think once you think more about where does the state stand for, you know, what are really its underlying competitive advantages, then you know, that might help you to make that choice. So if you say, you know, we are about sustainability and, you know, how we harness our resources, it might actually be that this gold mine has a lot of cost because it's undermining that positioning, at least if it's done in the way that has been conceptualized so far. You know, maybe you can be a leader in how do we actually dig out these resources in a way that's more sustainable, and it is not a barrier. But, I mean, I will absolutely concede there are these trade-offs, and there's no easy way around them. I think the only what we as economists can do is kind of put the facts on the table, but at the end of the day, that's still a choice that has to be made.
Well, that's a very good point, because I think we see it as sort of groups butting heads and thinking we can't do both, when in fact maybe we can do both. Maybe there's a new innovative ways to mine for gold without damaging the fisheries resource. And
right.
It's right. A big problem we have not solved.
No, I
thank you. No.
Dr. Kettles, I want to thank you again. My question is, you know, we're in the situation, it's kind of like the running of the bulls, where we're all there. We're running, and we are facing challenges, and, you know, the public is saying, hurry and do that yesterday. And we're in a deliberative process, and, you know, we're going through and we're making, you know, like I said last night at the summit, I see this as a unique opportunity where we're facing challenges, but these challenges provide us a platform of opportunity to do things that we might not have been able to do in another environment. There's a lot of motivation to do a lot of things that we've been talking about, you know, reforms, things like that. So can this type of new way of thinking, or like a paradigm shift, happen at the same time that, you know, we're in this challenging situation? And I know you mentioned one country that used a challenge like we have in order to be the motivating factor to make these changes.
Right.
What advice do you have for us in terms of where we sit right now?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the aspects where a crisis actually does enable you to do different things, because people know that something has to change. So, you know, just the status quo is not an option. And so that's an opportunity. If new things mean it costs money, that's obviously very difficult. So I think the easier way to start is really to see, you know, okay, how can we change the way we organize our processes? So that's why I focused a little bit on how you organize yourself within government. If you have to dramatically change that, and, you know, which slim down and make do with less resources, I think that is an opportunity to say, okay, maybe we create a different structure. You know, how we organize economic development, how do we develop an economic plan that's not just, you know, a budget, but really is a vision of where we want to go and what kind of competitive advantages we want to build. How do we bring in these other players? You know, how do we leverage what the universities are doing? How do we pick up what individual companies are doing? So I would focus on that side. And, you know, then if there are the resources. Obviously, it would be good to say, you know, well, we understand that we have to do something for our future. Here's a limited amount of money. You know, what is kind of, what are the best ideas where you think people from all across Alaska, this is stuff that we should shelter. You know, this is things that we should do even in this time where we know there is little money, because it's a good investment. And at the minimum, I think that could trigger a good debate, and people will come with ideas. But you're not going to make everyone happy, that's for sure as well.
And one final question that I have. We're faced with a bunch of proposals, and we're asking a couple questions, essential questions. How does any proposal affect the individual, the family in Alaska, and the economy? Are these good questions to be asking, or is there another set of questions that we should be looking at?
Yes, so I think on the economic development programs, so for me the question is really, you know, what does it do to productivity? Mm-hmm. You know, if you only make something through a rule or regulation or money more profitable for an individual company, but you're not changing what this company is doing, you know, making it more innovative, helping it to compete in other ways and creating these effects, and I think that's a test that I would impose. I do think there is an increasing recognition that the ultimate goal of economic development is the kind of level of prosperity that we're generating in our society. So we need to be very mindful about these effects as well, do things that are hopefully contributing to inclusive growth and these kind of things. So that makes sense to me, but I would focus a lot on this productivity question. Is this intervention going to raise productivity and change the value added that companies provide?
Thank you. Any final questions of committee members? Okay.
Can I follow up?
Senator Meyer?
Can I follow up on that? Dr. Kettleskin, thank you. And I'm probably going to ask you an unfair question. You know, the concern we have in this particular time in our history of fairly young state is what is best for our economy at this point in time. And some would say that, well, we shouldn't reduce our government size, and if you do, then that's going to put your economy in a recession. Others would say that, well, if we now start an income tax, or we increase the fuel tax, or if we, you're probably not familiar with this term, but our PFD, the dividend that we get, which is unique to us, if we reduce that, then that's less money for Alaskans in the private sector to spend, and that will have an adverse impact on the economy. And obviously, we're trying to find that sweet spot, that equilibrium where, we're not taking from the private sector to feed the public sector, but on the other hand, any advice that you can give us to help us?
Well, I do think the right answer depends a lot on your diagnostics of the situation you are in. So one aspect to this is, you know, is this a temporary drop of all revenues and we're going to go back in 2 or 3 years? So, you know, we just have to weather the storm. And obviously, you know, nobody knows. But I would guess that a lot of people in Alaska probably would agree that, well, almost independently of that, you know, we need to come to a different and more diversified and more robust economy. So just managing kind of an interim period is probably not going to be enough. And if that's the case, then I think I would be more skeptical to say, well, you know, let's just, try to keep up spending, and which you could sustain for a while, and say, no, you know, we need to start this process. You know, if we have savings, we have maybe a luxury of kind of doing that more gradually than other states. But I think you need to make that sort of adjustment. But it really depends on that assessment that you see. You know, what do you think the external environment will look like in terms of the oil industry, and what's your assessment of the underlying economy? Do you think, in principle, we have a sound and very competitive economy, and we just need to deal with this shock? Or you think there is a shock and our economy is really not very competitive outside of digging up natural resources and selling them?
Would you like to make a forecast on the price of oil?
I can, because, you know, I'm not an expert in it, whoever knows.
But, yeah, absolutely.
But my sense is this is more an opportunity for Alaska to do things that a lot of people in the state probably think that, you know, well, we should have done it, but it hasn't happened so far. And I'm, I was quite inspired yesterday from a lot of the comments at the conference. There was a sense that there was much less despair than I would have thought, and much more a sense of, you know, we have pockets of things that are actually attractive that we could build up, and it's possible. We have a lot of things to build on and assets, and that's where we start in the diagnostic things, you know, what are the assets we can build on?
Thank you. Dr. Kettles, the way I look at it is Alaska has a mature bureaucracy but an emerging economy. Do you think that's fair? And the reason I describe it that way is because I think we need to be we need to tread carefully on, you know, as we start looking at some of these proposals, because we have fostered, we're trying to foster more productivity, and you know, how do we know we're not going to go backwards?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's hard for me to assess how mature government or the government agencies are. But I do think this is a good opportunity to look at how you organize yourself and whether that's kind of a modern way to run economic development. And, you know, the sense is maybe you could do better, and that means also bringing in the private sector in a much different role. I should say, you know, if you're embarking on that road, that means also learning for the private sector, because they might not be used to taking that kind of broader perspective and saying, okay, so what can we do, you know, which is in our long-term interest but not kind of our short-term business priorities. So it will require learning and change on both sides to be effective.
Well, thank you again. I really appreciate you taking time to make an appearance here in the Capitol here in Juneau, and I'm really glad that you were on the record and so that your testimony will be there for in perpetuity, and if we have any questions, I noticed that you've provided your email, and we will let you know. But again, I appreciate it. And for the committee members, I wanted to mention we'll go ahead and be looking at Senate Bill 108 at our next meeting, and I want to thank the administration for staying and listening to the presentation. And with that, the committee is adjourned.